UK Wine Show, show number 56, Wines of Chile with Michael Cox. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 56 for the 22nd of June 2007. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're going to be talking with Michael Cox, director of the UK arm of Wines of Chile. Wines of Chile are the UK-based flag-waving promotional body behind the Wines of Chile, and the only office outside of Chile to promote themselves. We're going to be talking to Michael about what's going on in Chile and the new things to look forward to. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. In the news this week, rosés get a name change, and there's more awards for English wine in the International Wine and Spirit Competition. But first, Canada has got a new official wine region called Prince Edward County. This is a new DVA, or Designated Viticultural Area, joining Niagara, Lake Erie North Shore, and Pelly Island as Ontario's four main wine-producing regions. In 2000, the area only had one winery. Now it has 12, with plans for another two. The region is cool climate and has 15 different soil types. Riesling and Pinot Noir are already growing well, but it'll be another decade before the full potential of the region for growing other grape varieties is known. Meanwhile, popular rosé styles, currently called White Zinfandel and White Grenache, are having to change their names. Because neither are white wines, they fall foul of EU labelling regulations which came into force in 2003. Since then, wines with these descriptions, which are often from California, have been in limbo, but now the EU is adamant the names must go. Blossom Hill is the biggest brand of these types of wines in the UK and is set to change its labels from the beginning of 2008. The wines will be called Zinfandel Rosé and Grenache Rosé instead. And finally in the news this week, English wine has clocked up 12 silvers and 14 bronze awards in this year's International Wine and Spirit Competition. 10 of the silver awards went to sparkling wines, and Denby's took 10 of the medals, including two silver best in class for their Greenfields 2004 and the 2005 sparkling rosé. Ridgeview also did well with three silvers. The 2004 Merit Grosvenor and the Merit Bloomsbury were best in class, and the Merit Fitzrovia 2004 notched up the third silver. Other silver medals went to Chapel Downs Pinot Reserve 2001 and 2002, Knighthimbers Classic Cuvée 2000, Richard Balfour Lynn's Brew Rosé 2004 and Nutbourne Vineyard's Nutty Brew 2004. That's all in the news this week, but 40 years ago in 1967, British wine growers got together as the British Vineyard Association to call for a fairer deal on the excise duty for English table wines. They complained that the duty they were paying was a sherry-level duty, fixed for British fortified wines made from imported grape concentrate. For more details on this week's stories, check out the news homepage on our website, 3050.co.uk. That's it from me. Back over to you, Chris.
Cheers to that, Jane. The two stories that I thought were quite interesting was the renaming of Zinfandel and Grenache from Rosé to White. Well, I agree, it's a bit misleading. Taking one look at the bottle, it's fairly obvious that the wines aren't white. But that's the great thing about the EU. Consistency. It's so important. That doesn't sound right, actually, the EU being consistent. But I suppose I'm not opposed to a name change, so good on them. Of more interest, I think, is the IWSC, or the International Wine Spirit Competition, releasing their next tranche of awards. I do like how they release their awards throughout the year. I suppose they do it for two reasons. One is they get several cracks at the PR campaign, rather than just one big release. But also, in theory, the wines should be more readily available in the stores. Unlike something like the International Wine Competition, where results are released in one foul hit, and often the wines are already sold and drunk before the awards are released, so it's pretty hard getting hold of those wines. That said, I did notice that Denby's Greenfield 2003 won an award, and to my knowledge, there's none left in the country. We had the last stocks of it when it won the gold award at the International Wine Competition, and that was sold out within the day. I am a bit miffed that you get these awards where the wines are just simply not available to be consumed. But I'm not too sure how you could implement such a thing to stop that from happening. So maybe it's a devil you have to live with. but it is annoying. It's a bit like wine recommendation books. Yeah, the great thing about wine recommendation books is they're a great recommendation for wines that you could get 6 months ago rather than what's currently available in the market. I also noted that the International Wine Competition gave Denby's Greenfield 2003 a gold medal, while the International Wine Spirit Competition just gave it a silver. Still best of class, but still only a silver. There's something about the award system is that it's certainly not consistent, and the awards are not only given based on the quality of the wine, but on the stylistic preferences of the judging panel. This has been bothering me for a while, so next week's show we're going to be talking with Simon Waghorn, who is a man behind Whitehaven and Astrolabe Wines in the UK, and he enters a lot of competitions for his wines, but also he's a senior judge on the circuit, so he's got an interesting point of view on this. Next up is the interview with Michael Cox. Hi, I'm here with Michael Cox, UK Director of Wines of Chile, man whose family's been in wine since 1810, the same time as Chile's been independent of Spain. How are you, mate?
I'm very well, thank you. Yes, it's nice to talk to you. And yeah, indeed, the family have been around for a long time in wine.
You're the Director of Wines of Chile, but you've been in the job now since, what, 2003?
Yes, the Chileans asked me to set up Wines of Chile in the UK in the early part of 2003.
They did have an old generic body here beforehand.
And back in the late 90s, there was a Wines of Chile office here in the UK, which did some sterling work and helped to put Chile on the wine map, if you like. But the office closed in 1998, and it was only really in 2001 that a group of UK importers of Chilean wine got together and lobbied the Chilean wineries and the Chilean government to reintroduce an office. And I'm pleased to say that they were persuaded and some good funding was organized. Chilean government was prepared to help out. And an international Wines of Chile office was set up in 2002 in Chile. And they decided to put most of the budget towards the UK as a very important market. So this is the only office of Wines of Chile, dedicated office outside of Chile itself.
What's your objective in the UK with this office?
Well, the overall objective is to improve the image of Chile and its wines, and especially to help the sales and distribution of premium wines. This market is dominated by wines that are sold below £5. Chile is producing increasingly better quality, especially those that are selling above £5, and we have to develop that market significantly. And that is the overriding strategy of this office and the Chilean wineries themselves collectively.
Chile's got a fantastic reputation for producing good quality quaffing wines. Are you trying to enhance that, or are you trying to go for a completely different segment?
No, it's an evolution, and I think that is a great benefit to have that association with good quality, with wines that are reliable, that are attractive. And Chile already has in the minds of the consumer and the trade, of course, a very positive image. It's just that we have to move that and ensure that everyone is aware of the changes that have taken place over the years, especially in the very recent past, in the last 5 years, where there's been significant improvements in quality and opportunities to show Chile with diverse wines. And our job is to open people's minds and to help them to rethink Chile, discover the modern Chile, I call it.
What are the changes that they've had in the last 5 years?
Well, Chile is blessed with unique and very beautiful growing conditions, and so it is a great place to grow grapes and to make wine. But over the last few years, there's been a growing understanding of how to make that even better, how to seek better sites for vineyards, move perhaps towards cooler locations, whether it's out towards the coast, the Pacific coast, or up into the foothills of the Andes, or even simply up the slopes of the vineyard that used to be on the valley floor. To seek better locations, to lower the yields, to understand how grape varieties grow in different places, and just generally discover how they can get a sense of place and a sense of Chilean character to their wines. And that's been happening and is continuing, and it's quite an exciting process.
Chile's had, a few years ago there was a bit of a story about Chilean Merlot not really being Chilean Merlot. It was, in actual fact, Carmenere grape.
Yes, the Chileans have a wonderful expression. If something's real, they say it twice. So if you want a really good coffee in Chile, you have to ask for a café café. If it's just café, it's instant.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's the same with Merlot. If you ask a Chilean, he'll call it a Merlot Merlot if it's 100% Merlot. No, I mean, I joke, but a lot of vine cuttings came to Chile in the mid-19th century, especially from parts of France and Bordeaux in particular. This was because Chilean landowners were seeking ways to demonstrate their wealth and status, and they went to Europe to find things that would impress back home, and a lot of people came back with the idea of producing better quality wine from European rootstocks instead of indigenous ones. And so a lot of cuttings came in the late 19th century from Bordeaux, and as well as Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot, came Carmenere rootstocks, because a little-known fact is that there was a lot of Carmenere grown in Bordeaux pre-phylloxera. After phylloxera devastated the European vineyards, Carmenere, which didn't ripen awfully well in the Bordeaux climate, was not replanted. So it's virtually died out in Europe. But it was brought to Chile, but confusingly, most wineries confused their Carmenere vines with Merlot vines and planted them alongside Merlot. And so for years and years and years, grapes were grown in vineyards, planted with Merlot and Carmenere, but treated as Merlot. And it was only in the mid-90s that a French ampelographer discovered that actually there was a lot of Carmenere growing in Merlot vineyards. And it's, since then, it's been identified as such and grown and vinified separately.
Okay, and the Carmenere, the way they could tell, was the different leaf structure, wasn't it? The leaf looked quite different.
Yes, I mean, especially, it was. I'm no expert, but I'm told that in autumn, when the leaves turn, there's quite a difference in colour. But also, Carmenere ripens much later than Merlot. And so we had this bizarre situation that if it was mixed up, then either you'd pick when the Merlot was ripe and the Carmenere wasn't, or vice versa. And so since the 90s, it's been much better, But Carmenere itself, which is a great variety, if not unique to Chile, then certainly significant to Chile, is a very pleasing style, provided that the winemaker understands how to grow it well and to ripen it properly, because it is such a late ripener. It has low acid, but it is an appealing style if grown well, and that's happening more and more.
You mentioned about the different types of improvements. What sort of improvements have actually happened? You know, has it been in the winemaking? Has it been in the vineyard? Where is it going?
It's a combination, but I think, as with all wine, good wine starts in the vineyard. And I think I would stress that it is Chile's collective appreciation or growing appreciation of how to develop better vineyard sites in more conducive soils using techniques that suit those conditions that have really given the winemakers far better material to make better wine. And then on top of that, of course, you have yield and canopy management and all those other aspects of viticulture that help the winemaker. And then in the wineries themselves, there have been better techniques, better use of wood, more restrained use of wood, better use of stainless steel, et cetera, all those modern winemaking techniques that are across the world, I appreciate. But I think the Chilean winemakers, if you like, are discovering themselves and becoming a little bit more able to, a little bit prouder of what they can do, and also a little bit more aware of the beautiful conditions that they have and the opportunities that presents them.
A lot of people think of Chile as, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and recently Carmenere. Is that the three grape varieties that you guys are focusing in on, or is there anything else coming up?
Well, historically, and even today, Cabernet Sauvignon is the most widely planted grape variety, and so it is still Chile's strong calling card. And I have to say, it's what Chile does extremely well in most of the growing regions, especially those that the more traditional ones like the Maipo and the Colchagua valleys. But more and more we're seeing the emergence of grape varieties that are not new to the world but are newer to Chile. And 10 years ago Syrah was planted, only 10 years ago. Whether it's called Syrah or Shiraz on the label is up to the producer. But in terms of style, commentators believe that Chile has a big opportunity with Syrah, because of especially in the cooler regions, and indeed with Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir, which is the winemaker's ultimate goal. Every winemaker I've ever met wants to make the perfect Pinot Noir. Well, ditto in Chile, and there are some regions in Chile where Pinot Noir is looking to be very exciting, especially when the vines get older. But I suppose Chile has always been a producer of Sauvignon Blanc, and I think this is the great variety which offers Chile significant opportunities in the future, because there's no question that, again, especially in the cooler regions, the Casablanca, San Antonio with its subdivision Lleida Valley, and down south in the Biobío Valley and up north in Elqui, these are regions which are producing Sauvignon Blancs in a much, much more modern and I have to say higher quality and really very exciting.
How would you say Chilean, is there a new world country, because they're not part of Europe, do they produce new world style wines or old world style wines?
Well, it's an interesting comment, an interesting point, because in a very general sense, I do feel that Chile can offer a bit of a bridge between old and new world. Again, that's very simplistic, I realise, but if you take some of the more aggressive styles from certain new world countries, especially the hotter areas, and through to the other end of the spectrum, where in the old world, especially France, you might get much more restrained styles, Chile can offer something in between. But it's not really trying to copy any other country. It may have done that historically, but I think Chile is in this wonderful has this wonderful opportunity now to continue to develop a very Chilean style. But yes, in general terms, it is a new world country stylistically, because the temperatures are warm, not hot, and the fruit expression is very dominant. But it is developing complexity. It is developing a subtlety and a minerality in some of its wines, which might attract some old world aficionados that perhaps are a little tired of some of the wines that are coming out of their old favourite regions.
Just on a completely different topic, I did a podcast with Nicholas Ingham about a month ago on fair trade wines, and it was fair trade wines from Chile, and it really surprised me, because as a Kiwi, I always think of Chile as being just a normal country. I don't think of them as a third world country, which is what it says on the label.
Indeed.
In the fair trade
wines. And a source of some controversy in a way, because commercially, fair trade is a wonderful thing, and it's helping to promote a lot of good feeling around the world. And from a purely commercial point of view, it is a selling point. Chile produces, there are two cooperatives in Chile that are accredited to fair trade, and they're making good wine, and they are doing good things in the local communities. But in some respects, it is a bit of a paradox, and I'm pleased that you think of Chile as being relatively more advanced than one would associate with being termed third world. I don't think there's any official definition of third world. But yes, Chile is a culturally advancing, politically stable, economically very strong nation. And it is a country which is streets ahead of its Latin American neighbours in many of the indicators, both commercial and social. So there is a bit of a paradox, but I think there is no doubt that Chile can take advantage of being able to produce fair trade wine by accredited wineries. But the term third world doesn't sit too comfortably in where I'm coming from, because we're trying to present Chile as a much more advanced country than that would indicate.
Okay. One of the things that another person I interviewed a wee while ago talked about was the organic viticulture coming out of Chile. It's very dry, it's quite cool, there's not a lot of rain coming into Chile, but you've got good access to water from the Andes. So there's no problems creating organic viticulture, because you don't need to spray as much because it's nice and dry and you get less mold. Is Chile going down the organic route? Is it going to be, you know, organic therefore from Chile almost?
Well, there's no doubt that Chile has big opportunities to produce organic and biodynamic wines, because, as you say, the conditions in Chile are extremely favourable, arguably one of the most favourable areas in the world to grow grapes, to grow any type of fruit for that matter, in the regions to the north and south of the city of Santiago in central Chile. But whether to be certified organic, which is a relatively expensive and time-consuming process, Whether there are commercial advantages at the moment is the jury is still out. Whether the consumer fully understands what exactly organic wine is and what it stands for and whether they should pay a premium for it. However, I think we're in transition, and there's no doubt that the future will continue to offer opportunities for people producing organic produce, of which wine is an important part. And therefore, this is a great advantage for Chile, that has more wineries could produce organic wines than any other countries more easily, because the conditions are so good.
And what about biodynamics, which is basically organics on steroids, apart from the
Yes,
pump?
It's a wonderful subject, and I never tire of listening, especially to Chile's greatest exponent of organic and biodynamic viticulture, a young, very charismatic man called Alvaro Espinosa. I never tire of listening to him explain the biodynamics, which is quite a complicated process, but in essence it isn't. In essence, it is simply allowing the vineyard to go right back to grassroots and to behave as nature intended, and to everything to happen right from start to finish to be totally and utterly natural. I know that sounds very, very facile, but it is a wonderfully it's a wonderful process to learn about, because it is so obvious, it's so natural. But again, as a principle of producing grapes and therefore wine by biodynamic principles, which, as you say, is an even more advanced version of organic viticulture, makes a lot of sense. Everybody is more and more concerned about the provenance of what they eat and drink, and the purer the better. Chile is a beautifully natural country with wonderful conditions, and therefore easier to make natural products in Chile than elsewhere. And if we can quantify that and qualify that by using official expressions like organic or biodynamic, then that's an advantage.
Just on the climate, Chile spans not just 30 degrees to 50 degrees, which is your normal vineyard growing areas, that's why we called ourselves 30-50, but you do span the entire length of the latitudes of growing grapes. But it's still quite a cool country. What's driving the coolness?
Well, ostensibly, the coolness comes from a cold Pacific Ocean, which is made even colder by a current called the Humboldt Current, which comes up from the Antarctic and keeps the sea cold, colder than elsewhere in the Pacific. And, of course, the Andes Mountains, which are never far. I mean, Chile is only 150 kilometers wide on an average, and where the vineyards are. So you're never far from both Andes and Pacific, and this has a wonderful cooling influence in at nighttime especially, and also during the day. So you don't get these extremes of temperature. You don't get baking hot days, and you get very cold nights, which grapes are like people. You know, we love warm sunshine, but we don't like to be stressed. We don't like too much heat, and we don't like to be hot at night, you know, like in... I've been in the Barossa once where at night it was still 35 degrees and you're like a starfish in bed. Grapes are like people. They like to cool down at night. And so Chile is a nice place for a grape to be. But yes, the country is ridiculously long. I mean, if you placed Chile over a map of Europe, you'd go from North Norway to Mid-Sahara. But even the wine country, it spans nearly 1,000 kilometers from north to south. But it is, which in other continents or in other countries would be far too broad a spectrum for viticulture. But because of these cooling influences, that's what helps.
I think we'll wrap it up there, Michael. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Michael. I've had a lot of conversations about people talking about Chilean Sauvignon Blanc rivaling New Zealand from various people in the trade. At various shows that Chile has been at, I've been looking for these Chilean Sauvignon Blancs that are rivals to New Zealand. But alas, I haven't found any. Mostly they taste a bit like a mixture of South African or Hawke's Bay Sauvignon Blancs, which doesn't have such an intense, grassy, green, goosery type characteristics that Marlborough has. The other thing I found interesting was about organic and biodynamic wines. When I did a series on organic wines back in show 18 and 19 with Lance Piggott from Vintage Roots and Steve Karakaktanoudis from Robinvale Winery in Australia, both mentioned Chile. Steve, as a biodynamic organic farmer, was concerned that Chileans didn't have their heart in biodynamics and organic wines, and were looking for a way of getting a better return. while Lance were keen to source more Chilean wines because of the quality and price. We also reported in the news a couple of weeks ago that consumers are not really being influenced by free trade and organic wines. Makes me wonder, if the market isn't growing as much as the normal organic part of the sector, what's going to happen if Chile releases a load of organic wines into the market? If Chile floods the market with organic wines in the next few years, what will that do? Will it suppress pricing? And in which case, there'll be no premium pricing for this. And if you're in the market for that premium price and you can't get it because there is no market for it, then are we going to land up in a boom-bust type of yo-yoing situation? Not sure. Don't know. But food for thought anyway. This week's last word comes from Andrew Cheese, who is British and currently works in Stockholm. He enjoys catching up on the UK news via the show, and he reckons it's a great way to listen on the way back from work. But he would like the show to be in a bit more depth and a bit longer. And he reckons he just feels like he's getting into the show by the time we're finished. Not too sure if I want to go too much deeper into the show. It takes us a fair old while to put these shows together, and a longer show would certainly take longer to produce. So it's something we need to balance between putting the shows together and running 30-50 wine tasting business. That said, though, we're going to be running a survey in about a month's time, and it'd be great to get feedback, for example, on any additional content you may want us to add into the show, but also if you do really want it to go longer, whether it's the interviews or the news or what you're looking for, there would be a great opportunity to get that feedback from you. Don't forget, we've got some tickets to Taste of Birmingham between the 5th and 8th of July and Taste of Bath on the 28th of June through to the 1st of July. If you'd like tickets to either of those events, just drop me an email at chris.scott@ukwineshow.co.uk. Just tell us how many you want and we'll send the tickets out to you. Next week's show is going to be talking to Simon Waghorn. He's a winemaker who enters a lot of wines into various competitions around the world, but he also is a show judge as well, so he's the man who judges the wines. He's going to give us an in-depth view about what judges are looking for in wines and his attitude about sometimes his wines win a gold, silver, bronze, and just try and understand from his point of view why there's some inconsistency in results. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.